Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Ben's Friends is the food and beverage industry support group offering hope, fellowship, and a path forward to professionals who struggle with substance abuse and addiction. Ben's Friends exists to provide a safe haven and an anonymous, judgment-free forum for workers in an industry that has one of the highest rates of substance abuse in the country. Their mission hasn't changed during quarantine. Ben's Friends chapters across the country are now offering online meetings. You can find a chapter near you at bensfriendshope.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Melissa Fuster from Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies in Fort Coral Lee. Many of us know about sushi, but have you heard of Funa sushi? Historian Eric Rath shares his tasting notes from trying Japan's most ancient form of sushi. Eric is a professor in the Department of History at the University of Kansas and has multiple publications on Japanese pre-modern cuisine, including his latest book, Japan's Cuisine, Food, Place, and Identity. And he is also a certified sake professional. Welcome, Eric. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Melissa. It's great to be here.
Thank you. And I will also mention that Eric is a fellow member of the Gastronomica Collaborative. So thank you for joining us for on that end, too. So, Eric, from your undergraduate studies in Asian studies to becoming a certified sake professional, you have an impressive CV as an expert on Japan. How was the beginning of this journey? What drew you in the first place to Japan?
Oh, well, it was a family thing, actually. Mother's father, he traveled often in Japan. And my dad lived in Japan in the 1950s. So I grew up around a lot of chashikas in my house. And I became interested in where these came from. And then when I got to college, I was able to take some courses on Japan and learn more. And then I decided, well, if I'm actually going to learn anything, I have to go there. And so I spent a summer in Tokyo. And I guess I got bitten by a bug and decided to make a career out of this. And I'm glad I've been able to do that.
Yeah, I know. You have a very prolific career in this area. So your article in Gastronomica take us through your recent trip to Japan, where you travel around tasting the Funa sushi. So before we get more into this experience, just tell us, what is the Funa sushi?
Right. Well, I think most people know sushi these days, and the forms are nigiri sushi, the hand-formed sushi, which consists of rice with a little bit of fish on top. And then makizushi, the rolled sushi, the sushi roll with rice and various fillings with nori seaweed. Well, those two types of sushi developed in the late 18th, early 19th century. And funazushi actually follows a much older recipe. That recipe has changed over the centuries and has actually changed a lot in the last century, perhaps, too. But it's an older type of sushi, and the purpose of it was to preserve the fish. Nowadays, when you eat sushi, you want to have something that's relatively fresh, and you eat it soon after it was made. But funazushi was designed to be eaten months or years after it was made. It relies upon lactic acid fermentation. Basically, what happens is the fish is salted, and then it's packed with rice, and then put in a container for months, if not years, and over time, a lactic acid fermentation takes place. and the proteins break down. The rice becomes extremely pasty, extremely sour. This is the same reason why yogurt is sour, because of lactic acid fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
And the bones of the fish are rendered soft enough to eat. So basically what happens is the fish becomes pickled.
Mm.
And this was an old way of preserving fish and also of changing the flavor palette of the fish. So what happens with funazushi is that the fish turns into almost cheesy, meaty, sausagey taste. Mm. And what spurred me to try funazushi is because I read about it, and I read that this was the most ancient form of sushi. And I thought, if I'm writing a history of sushi, a book that I'm completing right now, if I'm writing a history of sushi, I have to go try funazushi, especially since nobody talks about what it actually tastes like.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what motivated my trip. And I learned on the way that the recipe has changed, you know, so much over the years that you really can't call it the most ancient form of sushi. Although the earliest types of sushi that were made in China, ancient China, and Japan were probably based on lactic acid fermentation, like funazushi.
Wow. Yeah. So, yeah, that was actually my next question. What motivated you to undertake this journey? But you are right. If you're writing the history of sushi, it makes sense that you will go and look at this ancient preparation.
Right. There's some.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead, please.
There's just lots of different varieties of sushi in Japan, and they're preserved as local foods. But funazushi is the representative example of the most, said to be the most ancient type. And this comes up again and again in all the secondary literature. People point to it and say, this is the most ancient form of sushi, but nobody talked about the taste. And so that really prompted me to figure out, well, what does it really taste like? And why are people not talking about it? Is it that they didn't try it themselves? You have to actually go to the region to try it, this region of Japan called Shiga Prefecture, which is in the central part of Japan. It surrounds the largest lake, Lake Biwa. You actually have to go there to try it.
Mm.
Is that why they haven't talked about it? Because they haven't actually gone there? Or is that was the mystery I was trying to solve, is why no one talked about the taste.
Yeah, so that was another, you know, as I was reading this piece, I was wondering how common is funazushi in Japan, but you're saying it's a more regional thing, original dish. But before we jump and learn about this amazing tasting journey that you had, I wanted to take on something that you mentioned. And if you can tell us a bit more about this, the variety of sushis that exists in Japan, because of course here in the West we get you know, a very, of course, limited taste of this rich cuisine.
Right. Yeah. Well, the type of sushi that we're familiar with, back to the nigiri sushi, the hand formed sushi, and the maki sushi, those developed in Edo, which is now Tokyo, around the early 19th century. So those were actually Tokyo. There's lots of other types of regional sushi, different fish involving different methods of producing the sushi. Some were lactic acid fermentation sushi that took months and years to create. Others were speeded up versions of that, whereby locals would take sake or the leftover rice from sake making, or vinegar, and then add that to the mix to facilitate the fermentation process. So there's all sorts of different varieties of local sushi in Japan. We just don't have access to them in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I bet it's we do have to follow your lead and go on a tasting spree.
Right, yeah, I wish we could do that.
Yeah, right.
So, for example, like in Kyushu, there's local sushi that uses sake.
Huh.
And some parts of the north of Japan, there are recipes that combine different turnips with fish. So, quite unusual types of sushi.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
At least from our standard conception of sushi.
Yes, yes. So I wanted to ask you, because in your piece, and I will take the opportunity to try to motivate our listeners to go and actually read the piece and look at the beautiful pictures that you have from this tasting adventure. So you went on a two-day tasting spree, right? Eating funa sushi at almost every meal. Can you give us just a overview of how this experience was before we go deeper into the experience itself?
Right. Well, I really wanted to get a handle about what this tasted like. And what I had read is that depending on the recipe, the taste is going to vary. So that's why I wanted to go to a couple days to eating as much of it as I could. And my headquarters for this, or my base of operations, rather, was Omihachiman, which is a city in Shiga Prefecture. And I had read that this city was famous for different varieties of funa sushi. So I went there, and I had booked a hotel, and I asked at the hotel, and said, where can I find funa sushi? And people ask one another about where I was, which for a moment, then someone at my end restaurant, and I thought, I don't really want to go there and spend $100 to eat funa sushi. Fortunately, I found a farmer's market map, and so there was one farmer's market about 3 kilometers away, and I walked there, and I found some funa sushi, brought it back to my hotel room, put it in the fridge, and then decided to do a little bit more exploring in town, and I discovered that a lot of the tourist areas serve or sell prepackaged slices of funa sushi.
Mm-hmm.
So it was rather easy, it turned out, to assemble different varieties of funa sushi here and there. And I should tell people what funa sushi means. Funa mm-hmm. refers to a type of carp, and it's a close relative of the goldfish. And the carp is about the size of a human hand, and that's the kind that they want to use for funa sushi. Preference is to have a female carp, which has lots of the eggs, a lot of the roe inside. And these are caught in March or April, and then the fish are cleaned, except for the roe that's retained inside the fish, and then they're salted until July or August, and then the rice is added to make the funa sushi.
Hmm. You know, yes, thank you for explaining that. That is, it's interesting how you mentioned it has a specific fish, and then the gender piece of, I mean, the sex of the fish, too. That's interesting.
You can use male fish, but there's a preference for the female ones. And if you ever see a picture of funa sushi, there's this orange interior to the fish, and that's the roe from the female fish. Yeah.
Okay. So we'll take a quick break because I do want to hear more about your journey and also how you write a piece about tasting something. But we'll get into that as soon as we get back from the break.
During this time, it's more important than ever to support our friends and neighbors in the restaurant industry. Restaurant Workers Community Foundation has set up a national COVID-19 crisis relief fund. The money they raise will provide direct relief to individual restaurant workers, support other nonprofits serving restaurant workers in crisis, and offer zero interest loans for restaurants to get back up and running. Visit restaurantworkerscf.org to donate today. And if you need a little extra motivation, you can DM your $20 donation to RWCF's co-founder, John DeBerry, on Twitter, and he'll give you directions for making a signature quarantine cocktail. Donate now at restaurantworkerscf.org.
Okay, and we are back. This is Melissa Fusser from Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies, in for Coral Lee. Before the break, we were starting to talk about funa sushi, the most Asian form of sushi, how it tastes. So now I wanted to talk about the taste piece. Sourness is a salient descriptor when I read your piece in this tasting journey. And it's curious how you also describe it using different types of ham and even cheeses so that the reader can kind of get a sense of how this dish tastes like. How can you tell us the process of how it is that you translate something so sensorial into writing?
Well, trying this funazushi was a bit like getting punched in the face. it was overwhelming. It was an overwhelming experience, and momentarily, I just had to recover from it. So I, to remember, I went around and I collected all various samples, and I brought them back to my hotel room, and I had a can of beer that I bought from the hotel vending machine standing nearby. I had opened that, and just took a small piece and put it in my mouth, and wow, I just was overcome by the sourness, and to the point that it made me grimace and made my head spin a little bit. I mean, I had to turn my head physically. It was a physical reaction, and just filled my mouth with this intense, sour flavor, and I thought, what is this like? It's not like yogurt. It's just 100 or 1,000 times more sour than yogurt. But what it reminded me of was this childhood memory of this sour candy that a friend of mine gave me. I'm thinking back like in second, third grade, there was this huge marble, like one of these shooter marbles, one of the bigger marbles. You put that in your mouth. And I remember spitting it out. It was so sour, but it had a little bit of sweetness. Now, if you imagine taking that sweetness away, that's what funazushi was like. It was so sour. And then after you have that sourness, then you can appreciate some other types of taste. There's this bit of cheesiness. There's this cheddar taste. And when I bought some of the funazushi the first day before I had tried it, one of the guys who sold it to me said, "Do you like French cheese?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." And he said, "Well, then you'll like funazushi." So there was this sort of a cheesiness, kind of like a French washed type cheese, like a brie, a very, very rough cheese taste. And that was the aftertaste after the sourness hits you. And then you have the mouthfeel. The mouthfeel is kind of like a sausage, kind of like if you buy a thin slice of salami and bite into that. That's what the feeling, the texture of the fish has become. And then if you try some of the rice, though, is completely like a paste. It's lost any of its texture, any of its sweetness, and it's the most sour part. Oh. So I learned that a lot of people don't eat the rice. Even if they eat the funazushi, they'll just throw out the rice.
But you did try it with the rice in the beginning.
Oh, sure, yeah. I wanted the whole effect of it, so rice and all.
And did you... So you do talk about different preparations or different ways that you ate the funazushi. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so this funazushi had this meaty, cheesy aftertaste to it. I had the opportunity to visit a restaurant that I knew sold funazushi, and I wanted to see what they did. I heard great things about this place called Biwako Daughters. And it was a bit far from the train station. I had to take a taxi there, and it ended up costing about $30. But it was well worth the trip, because when I got there, a restaurant that has been in operation for a couple of years, and they sold all sorts of sandwiches, including a funazushi sandwich. And I thought, well, I got to order this. And so for about $8 or $9, I bought one of these funazushi sandwiches. And what the proprietor had done, she took a very small slice of funazushi, and she paired it with some Havarti cheese, and then she put it on an Italian bread. And it was remarkable, because the cheesiness, the salami tastes, the summer sausage tastes really came out without any of the sourness. So I'd been to Tuscany once, and I went to this hill town. I had a remarkable sandwich there that a local friend had ordered for me, and I thought, gosh, I feel like I'm back in Tuscany, enjoying this, you know, secret salami sandwich. And there was no sort of sense of fishiness, no sense of sushi at all. It was really, really remarkable. We had it kind of as is, but then she grilled the other half of the sandwich for me, and that was even better because it melted the cheese, blended the flavors even further.
Yeah, and I am actually looking at the picture that you provided in the article, and it looks quite delicious. Definitely.
Yeah, it was. I mean, who would have thought a sushi sandwich, but it was amazing.
Yeah, no, and that's what's very interesting, that even though the Funa sushi is part of course, the history of sushi, but the tastes that you describe are so not the taste that people usually associate with Japanese cuisine.
No, not at all. But, you know, Japanese cuisine has changed so much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 50 years ago, people ate twice as much rice than they do today. And actually, there's a lot of wheat grown in Shiga Prefecture, where Funazushi comes from. If you walk around now, you're just as apt to see wheat fields as you are to see rice paddies.
Mm-hmm.
And people do eat a lot of sandwiches in Japan. So this seemed like a natural combination,
mm-hmm.
and a very logical one. It worked very well. And I think would be something that a lot of Westerners would like, a lot of Americans would like, if they had a chance to try it. Once they got over the hurdle that they were eating carp and sushi, if they would only try the sandwich, it would be, I think, revelatory for them.
Yeah, no, it looks good. I'm looking at it right now. So
I think people can download the article for free now.
Yes, and thank you.
Go to the Gastronomical website, they can do that.
Thank you for mentioning that, and we hope our listeners get curious about all of this and do go and actually read the piece and look at the amazing pictures. So you were starting to talk, for example, about bread and things that are changing because, you know, as we know, cuisines do change. And you write that talking about the funazushi, that it, again, is often described as the most ancient form of sushi, but that the preparation has changed. So how has it changed based on what you learned from your tasting and also what you have read from before?
Right, well, based upon the scholarship of some Japanese researchers, the modern-day recipe for funazushi probably dates just to the turn of the 20th century. And indeed, if you look at early modern recipes for funazushi, you can tell they're a lot different from what's happening today. For example, in my work on the history of sushi, I've translated a number of these recipes, and one of them, I believe it was for the 18th century, has a funazushi recipe. In that recipe, the recipe calls for brown rice, and it calls for making the funazushi in the wintertime.
Mm.
Now, today, people use white rice, and they make the funazushi. Those two different differences, I mean, those two differences point to the fact that this is not an unchanging recipe handed down since the ancient times in Japan, but one that it's been tweaked over the centuries. And that's one of the things I find remarkable about sushi in general, is that it's an anonymous food that changes through the years as it migrates to new places, as people's palates change. There's all sorts of developments in the history of sushi. And you can't really point to a person, a single person, as the inventor or innovator for sushi. It's an anonymous cuisine,
mm-hmm.
probably the greatest anonymous cuisine anywhere in the world.
No, and it is, I think, for when people, especially, I mean, speaking of myself, when I think of culinary traditions in places like Japan, you think of something that's ancient, that has all of this amazing history. And then, you know, what you mentioned about how things continue to change, and that is the case with any food tradition. But this
absolutely,
also,
yes.
But it also points to a tension that we can see, for example, in food scholarship or how people talk about food in general, that there's this desire, right, to preserve tradition and notions of what is authentic based on tradition. But then that is, you know, at the same time, change is inevitable. So how, you know, thinking of a dish like funa sushi, do people, when you were talking with people about it or tasting it, how do they talk about changes, or do they perceive these changes?
Well, I think there's a recognition made for different recipes, and there always have been just different. Every family that makes funa sushi, and it was originally something that families did. Mm-hmm. Every family that does it, they do it a little differently. They use a different type of rice. They use a different amount of salt. The restaurant Biwako Daughters, they throw in a little bit of the rice left over from sake making. So it's okay. You know, people recognize that there are different variations for that, just in the same way that people cook and they add a little bit of different ingredients depending upon their preferences. But I think, you know, in the larger point of reference, though, there is a recognition that funa sushi is something that harkens back to earlier days, you know, perhaps even to the ancient period. We're not so certain how old it is. There are records of sushi being made in Japan since the 8th century. What it was, we're not sure, but it seems likely that it was probably something similar to funa sushi. The problem is you can't draw a direct line, and that's where, you know, historians like myself come in. We have to be careful about these claims about the past because we just don't have the historical evidence. Whereas in popular writings or websites, when they talk about funa sushi or other culinary traditions, that those sort of things get elided very easily. People look over them very, very quickly.
Hmm. Yes, and you know, you mentioned just now that it is something that it is inevitably different because people make it in their home. I'm guessing traditionally that's the way it is, right? But then you also mentioned your first experience was with this prepackaged funa sushi. So is it something that the industry, that the food industry is taking on now and making it a process, or how it is that these packaged versions are in the market?
Right. Well, it's obviously time consuming to make. Mm-hmm. And if people want to have it, it's easier to purchase it, and it's not something you could find outside of Shiga Prefecture. You can't go to a department store in Tokyo and find funa sushi, although I should be careful saying that because almost everything is available in Tokyo in some way or another. But the packaged versions, I think, are for locals who want the taste of funa sushi but not the effort. And then there are also smaller sliced versions for folks who are tourists. Travel to Shiga Prefecture, they want to eat locally, and they decide, well, we've got to try funa sushi, so I'll just buy this packet for a couple of dollars and see what it's like.
Okay, so there is no worry or tension about something traditional being taken and packaged and, you know, industrialized in some way?
No, I don't think so, not in this instance.
I was wondering about that.
I think quite the opposite, that people see it as a way to earnest and also to make some money from local foodways.
Yeah. Oh, so it is something that is packaged locally, like you mentioned, at a market or places like that?
Not necessarily at a market, but a local food producer.
Oh, okay.
There are the companies, the packaging of the funa sushi that I purchased, they were all local companies.
So you mentioned how funa sushi, again, can be a potential new way of looking at sushi and maybe dealing with issues that we have in our fisheries and the fish that we are consuming more of with sushi. But what are some Can you talk more about the potential drawbacks of this?
Yeah, in the last part of my article, I kind of riffed on this idea about making funazushi in the United States. And the reason why I offer that up is several fold. First of all, I want people to think more about the fish that we're using for sushi. And a lot of the fish that are sushi favorites are threatened species or endangered species. One of them, in particular, bluefin tuna, that's almost synonymous with high-end sushi. People love the fatty total fish, that red, very fatty fish.
Mm-hmm.
But bluefin is almost endangered, or it should be listed as endangered, because we're catching it in an unsustainable way. And so to raise people's consciousness about that, I offer some thoughts about some sushi alternatives. And one of them is to consider using Asian carp. Now, mm-hmm. there are real problems in the United States. These four varieties of carp that were introduced in the 1970s have become invasive species in the Mississippi River and other waterways in the United States. And they're driving out local fish. They are sometimes even a threat to people on the waterways. These fish will jump out of the water and knock over people on boats.
Mm-hmm.
So they're quite, some of them are quite large, 90 pounds or more in weight. And I thought, rather than take some fish that's endangered out of one of the oceans, if you live in the Midwest, maybe we should take some of these invasive species that we don't know really what to do with and try to make funazushi.
Now,
carp sushi, there's a long history of that in Japan, but one of the hurdles will be to get people to try and eat carp in the United States, because carp doesn't sound very positive.
Mm-hmm.
Carp has a bad reputation of being a bony fish, of being a bottom fish, but actually compared to some types of fish, they're quite clean. For example, bluefin tuna, since they're predatory fish, they bioaccumulate mercury. Asian carp don't have that problem because they're not predatory fish. They're vegetarian. So there's a lot of positive health effects of eating Asian carp compared to some ocean fish. But, of course, there's another hurdle to overcome, and that's the technical one, actually trying to use these to make funazushi. And that would require a different sort of scale of using a 90-pound fish as opposed to one that's just a couple pounds. I hope we're up for the challenge. And I think that if we actually attempt this, we'll find that we produce a product that it would be favorable to a lot of Americans' palates, because people in America, they love cheese. We love salami. We love sausage. And imagine you can get that flavor profile not from something that's high in nitrates or high in calories, but from a fish. And that's what you could do with funazushi if you use the recipe for Asian carp. So we'll see. Maybe some bold listener out there will give it a shot, and I'll be able to try this someday and wash it down with my favorite beer from Kansas or Missouri.
No, I hope so, because it makes complete sense. It is one of those great examples of potential foods that can be good for the environment and also for our health. But unfortunately, as you rightly mentioned, there will be some hurdles to go through. And also, again, the idea that eating a fish could have the ham and cheese taste profile, I think that might get people, you have to really convince them, but it is worth a try.
And if they've done taste tests, if people are given Asian carp and they're asked to compare it to catfish, they like Asian carp a lot more most of the time. So it's not that the fish itself tastes bad. It's just we kind of have to get over our fear of carp.
Yeah. Again, it's unfortunately things that it's not the taste, it's how we perceive these certain foods. But we'll have to, right? Especially with issues around environmental sustainability and also health issues that we're facing.
Absolutely, yeah.
Great. So I think thank you for bringing that up to our consciousness. And I will second your request that hopefully one of our listeners might be curious about this and give it a try. And if you do, please reach out, because I would also like to try that too. So
yeah, that would be great.
Yeah,
that would be great.
And do let us know, of course, if you do find it at some point. So Eric, I want to thank you for joining us and sharing your work. And for our listeners, if you would like to learn more about Funa Sushi and look at these amazing pictures or other work featured in Gastronomica, visit gastronomica.org, where you can access the Spring 2020 issue for free until the end of this year, featuring again images from Eric's two-day tasting tour. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Gastronomica, the Journal for Food Studies, is an international interdisciplinary journal that presents new and original research, advances our understanding of compelling issues in the world of food, and invites critical debate and commentary across diverse audiences. We invite you to read and submit your scholarly and creative work. More details are available in our website. Gastronomica is supported by the University of California Press, and on behalf of the journal's editorial collective, I want to thank Heritage Radio Network, Meant to be Eaten, and its host, Coral Lee, for allowing us to share this miniseries podcast.
Meant to be Eaten is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.